Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, poets Marilyn Hacker and Dima K. Shahabi discuss their collaborative new book, Water to Water, Gaza Renga. This conversation originally took place April 20th, 2026, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, everybody, to this program at the American Writers Museum. Welcome to those of you who are here in person, and welcome to folks who are watching along online. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the museum. I have just a few short housekeeping notes before we get started. If you're interested in seeing more programming from the museum, you can join us as a member or sign up for our newsletter either with our staff at the front desk or online at AmericanWritersMuseum.org. You'll get advance notice and special invitations to programs and events like our upcoming American Writers Festival, June 6th and 7th, featuring Lauren Groff, Reza Aslan, Maggie Smith, and John Fugelsang, including many, many others. Thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight's program is part of our ongoing series, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. It looks at the ways in which writers have influenced and been influenced by the practice of religion in America. In Water to Water, acclaimed poets Marilyn Hacker and Dima Shahabi write across borders, physical and intellectual, in a deeply personal exploration of the humanity of those living through conflict, of being in exile, and of the limits of our words. Dima Shahabi is the author of 13 Departures from the Moon and the co-editor of Al-Mutanabi Street Starts Here, for which she received NCBR's Recognition Award. She's also the winner of the Nazim Hikmet Poetry Prize in 2018 and a recipient of the Best of the Net nomination in 2021, as well as several Pushcart Prize nominations. Over the course of Marilyn Hacker's career, she's received numerous honors, including the National Book Award, the Penn Award for Poetry and Translation, the Penn Volcker Award, the Argana International Poetry Prize, and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts. She served as a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, editor of the Kenyon Review, and editor of the French literary journal Siècle 21. She lives between Paris and New York. Dima is here with us in person. Marilyn joins us from Paris via Zoom. All right. Thank you very much. And Marilyn, thank you for being here with us virtually.
Hello. 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 Yeah, Dima.
Masa el khair, ya Marilyn.
Masa el nur, ya Dima.
Slami habibti. Thanks for doing this at such a late hour.
Jamila, Jamila.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for being here on this beautiful night in Chicago. I'm so grateful to be reading with Marilyn, who joins us from Paris at 1 a.m. And thank you also to Allison and to the American Writers Museum for this invitation. It's much appreciated. I just want to say, in many ways, writing is an act. It's a solitary act. Still, when Marilyn Hacker sent me an email about a decade ago with a Renga about a child from Gaza lamenting her fate, it set off a poetic correspondence between us in the form of this long braided Renga, which became a book-length project over time. This act of poetry, of this intimate space between writers, transformed, making the whole act, you know, the whole of it less solitary and turned into an act of solidarity. So it's beautiful in this way. We can start from Water to Water. The script leaps across the page to smack your lips, light burgundy in the sun. Elif ba kha, this is the language I breathe as love, you say, settling into a cry. The first loss is always.
A word emerging mid-throat, like the ein in an emigrant winter. A word that casts white-blue flame across the cafe counter. Nightfall, it's heady as the red wine they're drinking, to hear each other's stories in a third language, the bridge on which they first met.
What has changed for men in this world? She asks him as she wraps herself in black branches, powdered leaves, sidewalks, white as bone. She thinks of her mother entering her childhood bedroom to straighten shoes, the lopsided shoes, so that they don't disturb the garlanded angels around your bed, her mother would say.
Her mother would say, blacks, Puerto Ricans, Arabs, and that was enough. The front door slammed shut on the puzzled face of affection. All we were was what was not the darker other, with his long lashes, with her insistent questions. Beyond the locked door, a song.
More like a barrel of prayers. Soon they launch into Amin, their bodies perched on the Kaaba, like glued-on locusts on smooth stone. The girl says, what sort of devotion is this? Her mother drinks Zamzam's brackish water and thinks of another fountain in a deep pine forest in Latakia, long ago, the ocean sound in the trees.
The horse and the night and the wide desert know me, and this narrow street where fine rain falls before dawn, and the child in the next room coughing in her sleep, window in November cracked open, the beak pen and the wind that slips in with insistent chilly fingers.
In November, the Catholic woman married to the Jewish man sings, love the one you're with, her eyes gazing at the red bark of the sangokaku tree. They were each other's forbidden fruit. Now they'll grab up some apple pies from the Safeway aisle and celebrate another Thanksgiving without their loved ones.
Her father will die without seeing her again. He's 94 now. Safer in exile, they plan insurrections in cafes. She asks her husband, but who'll take power after your revolution? Thinks of the old man she loves, the hills near Latakia.
Thinking of the old man she loves, how trampled by sickness he's become, how he stubbornly smells like talc. When she smashes her face into his ribcage, she turns to the window to watch another Cleveland snowstorm, white ground, white blankets. No man will ever love her quite the same way.
Is it the same way she thought of the young man she ran off to marry? That she thinks of the woman she meets at the library? She didn't know then exactly what she wanted, but she wanted it, just as now desire wakes, if it is desire, with its eyes blurred. The litany flows under the Pont Sully, past four Arabic bookshops. One is run by anarchists. She stops to watch a barge pass. The Crusaders gave her those blue-green eyes, not that interrogative smile at the cadence of wind tangling her kinky black hair.
Beneath the bougainvillea pot and the jasmine lattice balcony, her brother looked back nervously and sees the stray mongrel cross the street in close pursuit. He thinks to himself, I've survived the tyranny of border guards and one or two wars, but is this the end? Death by dog in an unknown alleyway that smells of the sea?
Dogs on the port street fighting over a fish head, spoiled fruit. He can smell the discarded orange peels guards threw to exiled children. He was 16 then, no dog, no child, a teacher. Others learned to read from the tea-stained grammar book he'd grabbed up first when they fled.
On the morning of their first departure, he looks back from the car window to imprint an eternal picture of Jerusalem in his mind. He sees his mother holding up her palms as he drops his breath so no one can hear. Until we meet again. Who was that little girl with Damascene eyes holding her father's hand in the Shabandar Cafe, early morning 20 years ago on Al-Mutanabbi Street. Her eyes had excavated through him. Was it his loud voice that angered him, or his confidence among all the men? Maybe she's an expensive cabaret dancer now, and he'll finally find her concealed in a bar, incense hovering.
In Damascus, she reads her son's letter. He wants to translate a book a Jewish journalist wrote with a Palestinian prisoner of war from French into Arabic. His carte de séjour was renewed. As she folds up the foolscap, she remembers.
Standing on the balcony of her tiny apartment in Kuwait, overlooking the Gulf, the smell of iodine so sharp in her nostrils as she watched the neighborhood kids listening to Sabir's crazy stories of goat-hoofed spirits who linger at the fourth ring road. Dear God, she sighs.
Covering her face with the abaya behind the hired car's smoked glass. Mosul's main streets are jagged with potholes. Before the war, she drove her own car to the university. She thrust the letter menace into her book bag. Tomorrow at dawn, she'll go.
Visit her father's grave and read the Fatha. Who knows when she'll return? The word refugee makes her cringe. She'll go, but she'll carry the sound of his voice calling her name. How does one say farewell to Iraq, Iraq, nothing but Iraq? She grabs a fistful of ground.
Her hands full of earth, she kneels in red suede high heels in her small garden. She can hear the traffic hum out toward the Périphérique. She's planting jasmine after lunch in a silk dress. When she was young, though the rich had gardens and books, she made up the best stories.
Thank you. And I think now we're going to switch to the new section, correct,
yes.
Marilyn?
Yes.
Okay. And that's page 124, correct?
Yes.
Brilliant.
Okay. This morning, the streets are too hot to walk as far as the market square. Deserted now, anyway. Only a yellow stray dog sniffs empty wooden crates. I walked here anyway, just to be outdoors. No squash, aubergines, merchants, women with caddies choosing.
Choosing to defy all war criminals, the lone Palestinian, Rashida Tlaib, steadfast in her gaze in the Congress Hall. In her eyes, the land's anemones, olive trees. You go, girl. Your veins are Palestinian. Your smile from the river to the sea.
A river runs through Paris, where I lived for 12 years. Two hold Manhattan between them. The Litani rises near Baalbek, flows to the sea near Sidon, mired with industrial waste. The Jordan ends in salt water, sand, and songs. Now it's a river of tears.
The shimmer runs long on the Bosphorus, reminds her of Lake Leman. Summer rain blurs the news, torture camps. A boy makes his bed between his two dead parents. She curses all wars under her breath, questions the Black Sea. In the Sufi mosque, a whirl weaves sky and earth.
Leaden August sky in Manhattan. Everything aches. Humidity. Announced assassinations. Kill the negotiators? They do. Once I sat against the wall of the Blue Mosque with an Afghan exile, heads bowed. She whispered the prayers while I listened.
Under the white oak, she bows her head, copper streaks in her hair. The breeze is an ember. She counts five slain children on the floor. No mother, no father to pray over them. Half words from well-meaning friends. Only Faiz's poems calms. Where is the road to your lights?
The lights go on in 500 apartments I see from my window. Dusk of a late summer day. Home is an ocean away. Most of my friends are refugees and exiles at home in some new home with some new language to say independence, Huria.
No home but the one where dragonflies pond simmer, where the body moves as an auxiliary to other bodies, where plums rot and uncles, aunts, little bandits fade in, sing to what was once a blushing sea, an orchard, a long, verdurous kiss. Do we want to move on to our poems from our individual poems?
I think we read what we... Yes, why not?
Okay, I'll start. This next poem explores the relationships of mothers and daughters, and especially how daughters are often placeholders for their mothers. It's a sonnet sequence, and it starts with an epigraph by Agha Shahid Ali, who says, "For whose world is not in ruins, whose?" It's called Sun Theater Sonnets. You wrote me from a bed where you'd see the mountain's alders corral the sky. Who'll empty my last pocket when I'm gone? Once sitting with you on a fountain's edge, I unpinned the debris in my pocket into the basin where you had unfingered rose petals, their outline fading into our bleating desires, the still. When you passed, they transferred a ring from your small hand to mine, and I rested my lips into your mouth's smallest pocket. Oh, mother, I tore your letter and hurled my body to the sun-long corridor. Your skin was desolation. Come, hovering angel. Come, hovering angel. Desolation leaves me gray, chain-smoking by a quaking aspen tree who moans a throaty sea song when the wind bristles through its taut ribcage. I'm your daughter, holding a place, panting on a roadway where you leave me no sun to pass through. In a morning dream, I dwarf you, removing a seashore from your face. Then your lips move and you wave your hand. God Almighty, you say, your eyes sewn tightly, though you drag your thick desert voice over zoysia grass, exhuming miniature yellow butterflies and displacing them to a thicket of dusk after the wet. To a thicket of dusk after the wet, you pray. Do not let me leave this earth broken-willed, O coiler of sorrows, O lost root. Eyes like forest trees, you breathe it in whole while the mountain pelts you with clouds, semen-scented chestnut tree blossoms, Edelweiss. 30 years before, you trailed a messy son to your father's small tomb in Gaza, salt in your nostrils as the lemon light bound your eyes to the orchard's gray marrow. Decades later, your daughter averts her gaze from the limb-mined earth while her lover says, breathe. The soil coos and rallies her waters, for whose luckiest dead are at peace? Whose? For whose luckiest dead are at peace? Whose? Carantina, every seaside city juts a neighborhood where it's illegal sell jujube in the streets. Love disguises itself to feed you apricots, mangoes. Afternoons, pigeons thicketed the sun while we ambled underneath rusty green shutters. Do you remember how easily we held hands? How the sky was full of twigs when our skin touched? To open this hour is all you'd say. At the corner store, we hemmed our skirts, donning heels for long embroidered dresses. The seamstress swears she saw you as you were, a field misting the pond, a bent country. Thanks. Fadali Azizi.
Okay. Well, I'll read a sonnet sequence too, why not?
Okay, perfect.
Okay. Tired of asparagus and aubergines, tired of tomatoes, even tired of wine, tired of the village in its niche between the coast and the Mediterranean. She stays in bed, the window blanked till noon, then lights a cigarette, emerges from the sunken 23 hours dark bedroom into the sitting room, coffee machine humming, and on lucky days, the sun doing its best to be sustaining. Gloom waits in the shadow. Yes, I've also seen degenerescence in a wrinkled prune, a wedge of moldy bread, a chicken bone. And she's grabbed life back on the telephone. I might seize life back from the telephone when someone, what someone, any someone, not killing time, wants a conversation. It's cold. It's raining. The vineyards need rain, and apple, peach orchards, tomatoes, corn. I took my morning walk. I left my cane at the grocer's, hooked on a crate of clementines. Only remembered it walking between the square and the street, so went back again. I thought for those 5 minutes that my spine was redeemed, renewal, not decline. No twinges, phantom swellings, inflammation, absence of constriction, absence of pain. A long walk in the sunlight towards the mountain.
Beautiful.
A long walk in the sunlight towards the mountain might be one more invented memory, but I did walk there. Or a fantasy cobbled out of desire, some book, invention, and memory still. Yes, it's going to rain again. Like an old woman in a story, I feel it in my shoulders, my left knee, a vague ache, numbness, nothing more certain or defined. Swallows who've built their nests under the red roof tiles of the house across the way, swoop, zigzag, perch, then disappear. This street, like others, is a palimpsest, not mine, but one of mine. How many years? The smell of cigarette smoke wafts upstairs. The smell of cigarette smoke wafts upstairs, awake, alert, the morning round the bend. What do you say to your friend as you watch your friend give in to existential despair? I think on the roof terrace in the glare of just past noon. Nothing has happened but coffee, weather, rainstorms, and unending conversations on a screen. Elsewhere, again, he, she, London, Houston, Oslo, Paris, which always healed me till it stopped. Send news, books, travel, politics, explosion. There's war close by, though nobody I know is in it yet. The temperature dropped. The clouds move, and I follow their motion. The clouds move, and I follow their motion out onto the terrace, littered with laundry frames and clotheslines, parched plants, two geraniums bravely in leaf. Bird shit, green hose on the ground, black wrought iron chair, cushion that goes on it, waterlogged now. Clouds overhead. Here comes the storm. Thunder, a week of rain. It drums on the skylight, splattering commotion. Hailstorms. It's been a cold spring. Julie's daughter, an ocean away, plus half a continent, grew up here, is filling her in, the complexities of her 20s, chores, choices, everyday possibility, cross-country drives, a boyfriend, other skies. Cross-country drives with Julie, other skies of other decades, Greenville to Tucson, a campsite in a state park on a mountain, improvised food, insects, epiphanies of Southwest sunsets, and the backstories, all American cliche that we'd recount in earnest belief it had been ours to choose. On the road from somewhere to somewhere else, worries in duffel bag, car boot. I'd like to take off now across a valley, up and over a mountain. The roads are good, and I've good walking shoes. Conifers, a small lake, bird song. A fox, a squirrel, runs for cover. Except, of course, I never learned to drive. Except, of course, I never learned to drive. I was 11. Life changed. My father died. My mother inconveniently went mad. I got through high school and got out alive. Some distant college might have seen me thrive, take driving lessons that I never had. What didn't happen's heavily beside the point. I'm old, arthritic, more gratified by an alert and unimpeded now, walking up the school road with a cane, looking at mountains with a bit of longing for how I once walked, but walking every morning and afternoon. Church, cafe, stone house, bungalow, buying asparagus and aubergine. Thank you.
Thank you to both of you. I wanted to start by asking a little bit about the collaboration in this book. Marilyn, you had reached out to Dima with Arenga. What is that form for those of us that didn't know about it before tonight? And why did you choose it?
Well, first of all, chose it because it's a syllabic form that is basically made up of two or possibly three haiku stanzas, which is to say syllables, five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables, followed by two seven-syllable lines, and then the same thing over again. it's also, or at least it was always, you were talking about Japanese writers using it, it was always, almost always used as a collaboration. One writer would pick up usually a word from the last line of the previous person had written, and then start the next individual. The individual pieces are called tanka. And so we'd start the next tanka with a word from. And so it seemed like a logical, both an enjoyable thing to do, but a way to collaborate, whether we were sitting in the same room or whether, as it happened in our case, we were doing it across a continent and across an ocean via email.
Dima, what did you see in that poem that made you want to continue the conversation?
It was, you know, Marilyn's singular voice inhabiting a child from Gaza that made me want to just respond. It haunted me, the Renga. I think she sent it just to share it. Am I correct, Marilyn, at the time? I think you had just sent it to share it. Yes. And then she, I think, was surprised when I sent her another Renga in response. And then she sent another one. And then so on and so forth until it became a book-length project. So it was a surprise gift, really. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The poems are about closing distances, about exiles. How, as you wrote to one another, what did you discover that you were alike in, and what did you discover that you were different?
Wow, that's a hard question. I feel like there were more commonalities than differences. Motherhood, exile, you know, living like, you know, Marilyn herself is a polyglot, right? So, but I find myself to be like sort of a third culture kid. So I'm never at home in one place. I'm always straddling places, at least, and even though I'm in one place, but I feel like I'm straddling continents. And I think that's a commonality in our work, as well as I think just her preoccupation with, Marilyn's preoccupation with tenderness. And immortalizing certain moments really appealed to me.
Marilyn, what about you?
Something I really identify with in Dima's work is, and it's something we might share a bit, is an ability to go from the personal to being a Hakawati, which is just a storyteller, And in each of the Renga, there, you know, it's fascinatingly hard to know when it is a story of somebody in a different place and when Dima is describing not her own experiences or the physicality of the place around her, or what she has experienced, or is it an invented experience? And knowing that the number of places that Dima has lived, it becomes even more moody.
You've both worked in multiple languages. Mm-hmm. How much of the poet is in the translator, and how much of the translator is in the poet? How do those two roles sort of mesh and work together?
It's a great question. I think Marilyn is the master translator. I haven't translated from the Arabic at all, but I feel like how can I put this? Like, Arabic is my mother tongue. My sensibility is Arabic. My upbringing is in the Arab world. And so I carry that. It's the language. As I said in the Water to Water, it's the language I breathe is love. But I think Marilyn has gone even deeper and has translated from the French, from Arabic. She's translated Darwish's poems. And so I think she's the real translator, if I may say so. Yeah.
Well, I didn't grow up in any language but English, but I've spent so much time since I was in my 20s living a good deal of the time in France, so that it's become my second language, not just a language I learned in school and university, but I enjoy translating, and it's refreshing. It's a wonderful way to get out of one's own head, and be obliged to think about language in a different way, not just because it's bringing things across from another language, but because whoever the writer is, I'm translating, thinks about language in a different way than I do. And of course, since he or she is writing in another language, they're also thinking about language in a different way. Some of the writers I've translated from French are French Arab writers, so they too are thinking in two languages often enough. And I'm not making this up. I mean, they've sort of said so. I remember the Lebanese writer Venus Murigata saying that sometimes she felt as if she was writing in Arabic with her right hand and writing in French with her left hand, and wow. They would the languages would meet someplace in the middle.
What an image! Yeah,
that's a wonderful way to think about that. What struck me when I was reading Water to Water is that yes, these are difficult conversations that are happening between these poems, but there is also so much intimacy and love. There is food in these poems. There is sex. There is joy. There is the line, you know, how can she tolerate the fireworks? Mm-hmm. And how can you live your life while world events are happening? And I think that aspect of it, can you talk a little bit about bringing sort of those daily joys into this?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Thank you. For me, yeah, I mean, living through the genocide has been immensely, I feel like I exist on one plane, and which is the daily, mundane, quotidian life. But on the other hand, there's this, you know, thing going on that is hard to fathom, I'll put it that way. So weaving in the quotidian daily life of tenderness, children, beach, sunset, food, has been a way of coping. And I find that living through that has been like kind of expanding on the love that has always been there in my family. And just so bringing those daily mundane stuff just makes it much more of a real, it's, I wouldn't call it resistance, but there is in daily living a resistance to greater evil.
Yes, lovely.
So as you were writing these poems to one another, were there times when you took a step back from the project at all? Was there anything that, as you're writing, gave either of you pause?
Often, but I mean, and different kinds of pauses. One, just the pause that happens when you're trying to write something. Is this the right word? Couldn't I do? Is this too long? Couldn't I do? And and the formal syllabic thing. But
Form,
at the
yeah.
same time, of course, it's a conversation. And how is what I'm writing trying to say? How is Dima going to read it? And what will it bring up in her mind? What language? What song? What memory? And you know, where will the ball bounce back?
Yeah, the beauty of the Renga is that there is this wonderful, special built-in reader on the other side,
yes,
who's waiting for
yes.
your words.
Yes, yes,
right. And so,
absolutely, yes.
There,
a reason so to get up in the morning.
Absolutely, that's absolutely. So there's that built-in intimacy and this, like, every poet and every writer is seeking the ultimate reader, right?
Yes.
And so. By how I, you know, it's an honor and a joy and a pride, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, and likewise, like, and what better response could one wish for than somebody, that not somebody, but a friend, a fellow writer who is also a friend, picking up on something you just wrote and writing something that is connected to it, inspired by it, set off by a word or an image in it.
Mm, absolutely.
And I think you both had another poem that you wanted to read, correct?
I think we just did, didn't we?
I mean, unless your voice is starting to wear out.
It feels as if I read an awfully long one. I could certainly read another. Do you want to read another poem?
We can. I can read another short one.
Yeah, me too, and I come on.
Okay.
Rana's in Oslo, Fuad's in Liverpool, Rima is still in Hamra, Omar is still in Hamra. No one knows where they will be a week from now. I doom scroll newspapers. A bomb dropped on a school, a Christian village on a slope of hill with olive trees, bombed by Israel. No passive voice, Lebanon. Israel dropping bombs. Haza, two girls, three boys, disaster journalists, aged 9, 12, 10, who memorized a plethora of codes, tapping dispatches on a telephone, their troubled dailiness as background noise, unless the telephone beeps and explodes.
Ah, thank you. Vista. What goes extinct while grazing on memory's lawn in the sun? When you said I'd cut my tongue, I grew a callus over your mouth. Once I tiptoed to catch a glimpse of you, though I was not yours. But there was recognition through the window, my eyes knocking on cleansed glass as I closed further into sleep, into preludes away from you. Why am I speaking at all when what's unsaid between us is a rosette of moth wings beating in the sky's eardrum? I don't flock to passions when I seek you. If all was taken, who would you be? Still, I know what I sensed as I watched you swim out from under the bridge, trying to sip the Pacific. If it wasn't for the undercurrent, I'd have let you go further. But the hour was a cool blue cluttered with your lips. There's a story you know. It begins with your right hand over mine as I practice my handwriting. I lay my elephs here, like ripe fruit, like a home away. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both. Thanks again. And thank you to everyone who's submitting these questions. Just a reminder, if you're watching online, to type those questions into the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen. We have a question first for Marilyn. Did you become a polyglot for your writing or for another reason?
I like languages. Like everybody else, I started learning another language when in junior high school, but then I went on with it, and that first language was French, began spending more and more time in France, so it became a real second language. And I I started learning Arabic much, much, much later, and I've unfortunately forgotten a lot. Like I knew a lot more Arabic 5 years ago than I do now. But I hope I'll get it back. And of
And
course,
then it
being able to read in another language, read for pleasure in another language is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely.
And then a question for you both. How long have you two been writing these responses for, and how were you both able to write from so many different perspectives?
Great question. I feel like the first book took, was it 3 years, Marilyn, if I'm not mistaken? And then this is actually kind of an old book that became a new book. This used to be called Diasporinga. And then we added the water to water part at the end of the manuscript, which
Which
is the
was
new
written
stuff
last
that
year,
we wrote,
yes.
which was written last year. So I feel like the project is really, it's actually could be never ending. It could actually be like we could continue. But at some point we just say, no, this is, we're good here and we're going to end here. So it's interesting. So I feel like it's lasted, the conversation in my head has lasted for a decade.
Yes, absolutely.
We have a question here about the revision process in a structured call and response work. What was that process like for you both?
So for me, initially, I didn't write in this, I wrote in the Renga form, but not in the strict syllabic way. So I was kind of responding and not really adhering to the formal form, to the formality of it. In the second part, when I wrote water to water, it became much more like I wanted, like that formal feeling. I wanted to stick to the syllabic form, and I wrote strictly in syllables. So I feel like that's a bit of a change as well. How about for you, Marilyn?
I think because of the syllabic form, there was a lot less rewriting, except for no change in tweaking, changing one word here or one or what or one word there. But it was rather like doing a piece of sculpture rather than a painting. It was really much but much harder to even if it's a small sculpture, it's much harder to redo. And so. I mean, obviously, change a word, change a word, change a word. But there was, I think, much more attention to the having picked that word, sculptural quality. Tiny sculptures, but sculptures nonetheless. And I love the process of. Because it's a call and response, not knowing what was going to come next, not knowing what I was going to have to and want to respond to, and I love that.
Here's another question. Did you know each other's work prior to Marilyn reaching out?
Yes, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was introduced to Marilyn's, I was reading her presentation piece long ago, and then I think we started talking. I think was introduced to her ghazals right after that,
Yes.
and then went back and read her names and a few other like books. So yes, I've known Marilyn's work for a long
Yeah.
time.
And I had good fortune of being introduced to Dima by a mutual friend, the poet Fadi Judah. And so
Yeah.
basically, this is someone you should know, and he was right.
Yeah, it was a gift of an
Yes.
introduction.
And just we have time for one more question, so I thought we'd end with this one. How and when did your relationship progress to that of friends?
That's a very sweet question.
Yes.
I feel, go ahead, Marilyn. I feel
No,
like we were, I mean, as an admirer of long-term admirer of Marilyn's poetry, of course, it's like an honor to be her friend,
No, but alas.
But I think we became friends when we actually like met and traveled together and
Yes.
traveled by train. And when we traveled by train, we would cause a ruckus. We would giggle a lot, and the conductor would actually
Yes.
ask us to kind of tone it down a little bit on train. So I feel like that's when our friendship started. Just like that, started kind of coming into fruition. And so it's during the first, when we released the first Diasporinga and we traveled together, our friendship, I felt, blossomed.
Yes. Would that we were doing that now, but it's great to see you.
Indeed, indeed.
You can tell what a friendship is genuine when you're talking over one another.
That's a great way of putting it, Allison. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. And I'm going to sneak in one more question. I know I said that was the last one. I'm going to sneak in one more. And please correct me if I'm reading this wrong. But with suffering and creativity, is the one a prerequisite for the other?
Very heavy. Very good question.
Sorry.
Is the one a prerequisite for the other?
Suffering and
creativity. Oh, I certainly hope not.
Suffering and creativity.
I would say, you know, certainly sometimes there is a wellspring of creativity that comes out of suffering, but it's absolutely, I don't think suffering is, only the suffering of the hard work part, the suffering of the get it right, but damn, that's not the right word. Anything can be a wellspring of creativity, suffering, pleasure, joy, a flower or a bird or a child running down the street or falling and scraping your knee, all of those. a piece of music or reading something by somebody else or trying to translate something that somebody else has written. There are fortunately so many things that can be that can get that going. If what you do is right, anything. Sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes absolutely anything can set it off. You know, damn, it's raining, for example.
No, I think that's beautifully put. I couldn't, but I'll just want to add for me, the big wellspring of creativity has been my childhood, and thinking of my parents, and that kind of love has been like a big wellspring of creativity specifically. But
and it was an interesting childhood.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you both for this incredible conversation.
Oh, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you,
Allison. This was wonderful. And thank you all for being here tonight. Can we give our poets one more round of applause, please? Or in Marilyn's case, thank you for being here this morning. It's been wonderful to have you all here. If you don't yet have a copy of Water to Water, you can purchase one at the front desk. And Dima will be signing it here at this table. So thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Marilyn.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you. Ilali Kalkari,
inshallah. Ma'asalama.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Good night. Thanks for staying up.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.